Father God, I come to you in the name of Yeshua, in need of you to speak, and not me so much. Bless this time in your word. We love you, we need you, we can't live without you, O Lord. Amen. Okay, so this is the first Torah portion of Leviticus. That's obvious because we're starting in Leviticus chapter 1, right? The Torah portion is called Vayikra, and Vayikra means, and he called. And of course, the he that called is Yahweh. And in my Bible, and I'm using NIV today, starts off saying, and Yahweh called to Moses. Leviticus was given to Moses during the year that Israel was camped at Mount Sinai, before they began their journey to Canaan. So the content of Leviticus has a natural narrative flow from the end of Exodus. In Exodus, we see that Yahweh delivers Israel from Egypt, its gods, and its people through many acts of power. And then he protects and provides for Israel by his presence and loving kindness, visibly seen in the pillar of cloud and fire. Then, at the end of the book of Exodus, his presence is seen and experienced in the glory cloud upon and in the tabernacle, or the tent of meeting. Earlier in Exodus, over seven chapters, Yah gives instructions for the building of the ark, the tabernacle, and for the priesthood, and that's chapters 25 through 31. Later in the book, there are six chapters describing the making and assembly of the tabernacle complex. These chapters seem to duplicate much material when Yahweh gave the instructions for the building of the tabernacle over seven chapters, not much earlier in the book. So Exodus ends with the glory cloud filling the tabernacle. This, in part, is why I named the last teaching, the dwelling of Yah among us. So let's turn back to Exodus 40, chapter 34. And in my Bible, I don't even have to turn a page. It's right there on the opposite side. It says in 40:34, it says, "Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of Yahweh filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled upon it, and the glory of Yahweh filled the tabernacle." And in just these two verses, they kind of duplicate each other, talking about the glory of Yah filling the temple, then the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of Yahweh filled the tabernacle. So obviously that's very important. Now, here we see the Shekinah glory of Yahweh covering the tent of meeting in a cloud. The word Shekinah is a Hebrew word or name meaning dwelling or one who dwells. The Hebrew root for dwelling, from which we get the word Shekinah, is comprised of three Hebrew letters, Shin, Kaf, and Nun. So the sounds they make are Sh, K, and N. In this passage, we see a number of words with the Sh, K, N root. So three of these words are Shekinah, dwelling, or one who dwells. Mishkan, and that's tabernacle. That's kind of where we get the word sukkah. Then Shokin, which means to dwell with us. And then there's another word that's not seen here, and that's called Shachin. Again, you can hear the three letters of the root. Shachin, the sh, k, and the Nun, the N. And that word is the word for neighbor. So isn't it interesting that that same root, kind of the S, the K, and the N, is for Shekinah, the dwelling, Mishkan, the tabernacle, Shokin, to dwell with us, and then Shachin, for neighbor. Someone just recently shared with me regarding these verses that the Shekinah glory of Yahweh came upon the Mishkan, which is the tabernacle, because Yahweh wanted to shokin, which is to dwell with this, so that we can love our shachin, our neighbor, shachanim, neighbors. So with these last verses of Exodus serving as a transition into Leviticus, if the dwelling of Yahweh among us is a legitimate theme of Exodus, what I see as a legitimate theme in Leviticus is then maintaining the presence of Yahweh among us and right relationship with him and our neighbor. And this very much has to do with the sacrifices, the priesthood, laws for what is allowed for Yah's people, clean and unclean, and for regulating how Yah's covenant people are to interact and resolve conflict among themselves. This is what Leviticus is all about. So I'm not going to title this teaching because it's too long and gnarly, but if I were, it would be maintaining the presence of Yahweh among us and right relationship with him and our neighbor. Again, that's too long and gnarly for a title, but that would be it if that's what I were calling it. So let's get into Leviticus. Just so you know, in case you get a little bit nervous as I'm proceeding through this, I'm going to start with more detail with regard to the sacrifices. And then as I go further, I'm going to get skimpier on the detail. So first, you know, the portion is from 1:1 through 6:7. And these are instructions on offerings for the perspective of the Israelite community, that is the people. So, we've got that if you have a Bible that has paragraphs and maybe kind of subject headings, we can look real quick. And I'm hoping you'll have your Bibles open and be tracking along with the verses with me. In some spots I'll go quickly, but I'm hoping you'll be interactive with the Bible in front of you, on your lap, something. So in the burnt offering, chapter 1, verse 2, it says, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when any of you brings an offering to the Lord, to Yahweh, bring as your offering an animal from either the herd or the flock." So my point here is that the discussion of these offerings, again, are from the perspective of the Israelite community, the people. It's for them. For the grain offering, that's the next offering, and it goes by chapter here. Chapter 2 is the grain offering, and you look at chapter 2, verses 1 and the first part of 2. When someone brings a grain offering to Yahweh, his offering is to be a fine flour. He is to pour oil on it, put incense on it, and then take it to Aaron's sons, the priests. So we see, again, this is focused on the people. The fellowship offering, chapter 3. If someone is offering a fellowship offering and he offers an animal from the herd, he is to present it before Yahweh, an animal without defect. He is to lay his hand on the head of the offering, and he is to slaughter it at the entrance to the tent of meeting. Then Aaron's sons, the priests, shall sprinkle the blood. And then the sin offering, chapter 4. Yahweh said to Moses, "Say to the Israelites, when anyone sins and does what is forbidden," so it's again, "say to the Israelites." And then the guilt offering, chapter 5, verse 14. Yahweh said to Moses, "When a person commits a violation and sins unintentionally in regard to any of Yah's holy things, he is to bring to the Lord as a penalty a ram from the flock." So after this Torah portion, the beginning of the next one, chapter 6, verses 8 through 7:21, the instructions are on those same offerings. So it's a repetition, but now it's for the perspective of the priests. And we can see that in 6:8. It says, this is for the burnt offering. Yahweh said to Moses, "Give Aaron and his sons this command. These are the regulations for the burnt offering." So that's a command not to the people that are bringing the sacrifice, but to the priesthood. The grain offering, 6:14, we see these are the regulations for the grain offering. Aaron's sons are to bring it before the Lord in front of the offering. The sin offering, 6:24, Yahweh said to Moses, "Say to Aaron and his sons, these are the regulations for the sin offering." And then the guilt offering, 7:1 and 5. These are the regulations for the guilt offering, which is most holy. And then verse 5, the priest shall burn them on the altar as an offering. So again, that's going into the next Torah portion, but my point is what we're covering today, you know, if we're not paying attention and we're just reading quickly or doing what, you know, some Bible reading plans say, read a chapter a day, you just think it's a repetition on these offerings and you don't know why. Well, here's why. The ones we're covering today are for our instructions for the people. And it has some instructions for the priest, but it's mainly for the people. And the second set, beginning in chapter 7, or the latter part of chapter 6, those instructions are primarily for the priests for the same offerings. And that's why the difference. It's interesting that this repeating of instructions for the offerings kind of seems to parallel the repeating of the elements and the construction of the tabernacle in Exodus. And I kind of beat it to death last week that, you know, there were some earlier chapters that talked about all these elements and how they were to be put together and all of that. And then here we were again in another patch of what seemed to be repetition. The first batch were how to make it, and the second batch of chapters was they made it. Okay, so at Leviticus 1:1, it says, Yahweh called to Moses and spoke to him. So this is introducing the burnt offering, but by its absence in introducing the grain and fellowship offerings, the statement is introducing all three of these. So that statement is Yahweh called to Moses and spoke to him. So that's what it says at 1:1. And 2:1, it doesn't say Yahweh called to Moses and spoke to him. It just says when someone brings a grain offering. In verse 3, it's the fellowship offering. It's a new offering. It doesn't start out saying Yahweh called to Moses and spoke to him. It just says if someone's offering is a fellowship offering. So because the next two of the five offerings I'm getting stuck in my notes. So there's the first three. They're introduced at the burnt offering by saying Yahweh said unto Moses. The second two don't say Yahweh said unto Moses. Then the final two, they do start off saying Yahweh said to Moses. And so some people are seeing in this that first introduction, Yahweh said to Moses, is for the first three offerings, the burnt offering, the grain offering, and the fellowship offering. And then the other two offerings, the sin offering and the guilt offerings, are in a certain sense derivatives of those first three offerings. And we see that because they use and refer back to elements of those first three offerings. So at 4:10, that's the fourth offering, it says, just as the fat is so again, this is the sin offering, verse 10, just as the fat is removed from the ox, sacrificed as a fellowship offering. So it's saying you're to do all this in the same way as you do for the fellowship offering, and that's before. In verse 24 of chapter 4, it says, he is to lay his hand on the goat's head and slaughter it at the place where the burnt offering is slaughtered before the Lord. But this is a sin offering. In verse 26, it says, he shall burn the fat on the altar as he burned the fat of the fellowship offering. And there are other references as well. So the point is, and I don't mean to be so repetitious, but I'm going to be even more so a little bit later, that the first three offerings are kind of like the main offerings, and the other two, they're also main offerings, but they kind of derive from the first three in some of the instructions, the way things are to be done, and it specifically says so in those other chapters about the latter two offerings. Okay, let's get into it in detail now. The burnt offering is verses 3 through 17 and up chapter 1. So Leviticus 1, verses 3 through 17. It starts off, if the burnt offering is from the herd or is from the cattle. So that portion of the burnt offering is verses 1 through 9. Then in verses 10 through 13, verse 10 starts out and says, if the burnt offering is from the flock, a lamb, a ram, or a goat. And so now the third section of the burnt offering starts at verse 14, and it says, if the burnt offering is of the fowl, doves, or young pigeons. So the burnt offering, there are three different kinds of animals that you can offer. And so we'll go through each of those stage by stage. Verses 1 through 9, we see in verse 3, it says, let me get there. If the offering is a burnt offering from your herd, he is to offer a male without defect. So it says he is to offer. Who is the he is to offer? This is the Israelite. It's not the priest. And then it says he's to offer a male without defect. Why a male? Why a bull and not a cow? Well, one suggestion is that in herds, it's the females that are the most productive, and that the males kind of reduces the least important members of the herd. Females were necessary for breeding and producing milk, and that made most males unnecessary, and the males took up valuable grazing land. And, you know, modern cattle herders, breeders, maybe cowboys is the word, I'm not sure, they just need one bull for up to 60 females. And of course, you know, modern breeding, they're all about cutting out unnecessary cost. So while maybe they didn't do 1 to 60 in Israel, I think when Yahweh says to bring a male for an offering, that's a part of his grace, of his gracious provision for the sacrifice. It's also at the same time, making it so that the least useful members of the herd are being sacrificed, and it's better economically. So verse 4, it says he is to lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering. Again, the he that's laying his hand on the head of the burnt offering, this is the Israelite. It's not the priest. Verse 5, he shall kill. Verse 6, he shall flay or take off the hide or the skin. Verse 9, he shall wash the inner parts of the leg. I highlight this because in the past, I myself didn't realize as I was reading through these things for the many sacrifices that in these first chapters, it wasn't the priest who did these aspects of the offerings. But in verse 5, it does say, the priest shall bring the blood and sprinkle it around the altar. In verse 7, it says, the sons of Aaron shall put fire on the altar and lay wood in order on the fire. Verse 8, it continues, and the priest shall lay the parts of the bull on the fire on the altar. Verse 9, the priest shall burn all upon the altar. So there's a role for the priest. These first chapters focus on the people bringing the sacrifice, but the people need to know what to expect that they're going to do and what the priest is going to do. And the priest can look at these instructions and also see their part as well. And it'll be a part of the instructions that we see in the next Torah portion. But there'll be more specific things for just the priest in that next Torah portion. So verse 9 says, the priest shall burn all upon the altar. All? Yes. The burnt offering is the whole thing. Nothing is held back for the priests or the Israelites making the offering. Okay, the second section under the burnt offering, verses 10 through 13. The Israelite shall, verse 11, he shall kill. Verse 12, he shall cut into pieces. Verse 13, he shall wash the legs with water. But the priests, they shall, in verse 11, sprinkle the blood around the altar. Verse 12, lay the pieces of the animal in order upon the wood on the fire which is on the altar. In verse 13, the priest shall bring and burn upon the altar. Okay, the next section, verses 14 through 17. If the burnt offering is of the fowl, doves or young pigeons. Something I want to point out here, it says doves are young pigeons in my translation. Years and years ago, my wife and I had three little girls at home. Actually, it was just two at the time. And the kids always wanted a dog. And we never wanted to get a dog because the dog is too difficult of a pet, too high maintenance, all this. So we did the fish, we did the rabbits. The rabbits didn't last long. We did this, that, and the other thing. And one of the things we did on our way to eventually finally getting a dog was doves. And doves, they were beautiful. We got two doves in a cage. We put them in kind of our living room. They make all kinds of noise. They sound an awful lot like pigeons. So we did a little research. Basically, a dove is a white pigeon. So if you've got all this beautiful, warm, fuzzy feeling about a dove and you think a pigeon is just a dirty bird, it's the same thing. The dove is just white. Just thought I'd pass that on. So verse 14 of chapter 1, it says, if the offering to Yahweh is a burnt offering of birds, he's to offer a dove or a young pigeon. Then verses 15 through 17, the priest does everything with the fowl, and the fowl were given to the priest alive by the offer. And you know, we don't see the offerer doing all the things he does with the bull or the things from the flock. I suspect because the birds are so small that it's impractical for the offerer to kill the bird and then pass it to the priest once it's bleeding and all that gory stuff. And in verses 9, 13, and 17, and this is kind of summarizing from each of the sections, the burnt offering of the bull, the flock, or the fowl. It says it is a burnt offering, which means the whole thing, an offering made by fire, and an aroma pleasing to Yahweh. So that's the burnt offering. Chapter 2 is the grain offering. The grain offering is to consist of flour, oil, and incense. And when some bring, and this is verses 1 and 2, when someone brings it, he is to pour and put, and then take it to the priests. So again, you know, the emphasis is on the Israelite, the common person bringing the offering to the priests. Verse 2, it's to be burned on the altar, a sweet savor or aroma pleasing unto Yahweh. 2 and 3, it's the priest that offers. But he offers only a handful. When he does the offering, only a handful is burned on the altar. The rest of it goes to the priests. So, and in verse 3, this portion that's not burned on the altar, that goes for the priests, is said to be a most holy part of the offerings made unto Yahweh. Even though it's not burned on the altar, and even though it's used by the priests to pretty much just feed their families. Okay, so verses 4 through 11. So chapter 2 is the grain offering. Verses 4 through 11 is talking about the regular grain offering. And so again, this chapter is divided up into two parts instead of three like the previous chapter. 4 through 11 is the regular grain offering. And then verses 11 through 16, it's verse 11 transitions into a grain offering, which is for a first fruits offering. So we'll get to that in a minute. Hello, John F.
Hello.
We keep our microphones turned off until we're talking, and I'm in the midst of a teaching right now. So everybody's kind of in listening mode for a little while yet while I continue the teaching. Very good. So verses 4 through 11 of Leviticus chapter 2. Verse 4 says the grain offering is of cakes or wafers baked in an oven. So these are made without yeast. They're made with fine flour and oil. In verses 5, 6, so verse 4, so now they're breaking up the regular grain offering into three different times kinds of regular grain offering. So verse 4, it's a grain offering of cakes or wafers that are baked in an oven. verses 5 and 6 is a grain offering made on a griddle. And both of those are to be made without yeast and made with fine flour and oil, not coarse flour, but fine flour. And then verse 7 is for a grain offering if cooked in a pan. Maybe that's like a pancake or something. And while this doesn't specifically say it's without yeast, it's to be made with fine flour and oil. In verse 8, it says, bring the grain offering to Yahweh and give it to the priest. Again, this instruction is to the people, and the priest is in third person. And the priest, he shall take it to the altar. This is what the people shall do, and it explains to the people what the priests will do with their offering. In verses 9 and 10, it says the priest shall take only a portion, or just a memorial, of what is offered, and burn that on the altar, and that is an aroma pleasing to Yahweh. And the rest is for the priests. And this greater portion for the priest is said to be, again, a most holy part of the offering made to Yahweh by fire, even though it's largely not itself burnt. So I imagine that here it says that this part, the part that the priests get, is said to be a most holy part of the offerings made to Yahweh by fire. Very likely so that the people wouldn't say, hey, I brought this to Yahweh to sacrifice it to him. The priest only put a handful in and the rest he kept for himself. That's no good. That's not right. Well, here in part of the instructions in instituting the offering, Yah says, no, that is right. And that too is a most holy part of the offering. Interesting how they offer a big bunch of it. And the priest only takes a handful and puts it in the fire. And I see a parallel here to tithing, as we've been taught it over the years, where, as I've been taught it, is that, you know, everything that we earn and that comes into us, it all belongs to the Lord. And yet we offer up 10% and we give that to the church or whatever, for, you know, as unto the Lord. But that's, you know, that's the part that represents that all of it belongs to him. So again, I see a parallel there. Verse 11 is a summary and a transition to the first fruits offering. So in the summary, it says that any and all grain offerings are to be made without yeast or honey. So I said just a few verses back that the grain offering that was first cooked in a pan, it said it's to be made with oil, but it didn't say it's without yeast. Well, here in the summary statement, it says it's not to have any yeast in it along with the rest of them. And then it also says without honey. So now there's a transition to grain offerings made as first fruit offerings and then instructions for the first fruit grain offerings. And of course, the first fruit offerings are grain offerings. Verse 12. The first fruit offerings are not to be offered on the altar as a pleasing aroma to Yahweh. Now, it doesn't say that, but it doesn't. What it doesn't say is these offerings are made as a pleasing aroma to Yahweh. All of the others said that. But in the first fruit offerings, it just says they're to be offered unto Yahweh. Verse 13, all the grain offerings are to be seasoned with salt. That's the first time we see this, and it speaks of the salt of the covenant. Verse 14, unlike with regular grain offerings that we talked about just a minute ago, those are to be of fine flour. But the first fruit offerings, they're not to be of fine flour. They're to be of crushed heads of new grain. Obviously, that's very coarse. And they're to be roasted or dried in the fire. And then in verse 15, as with the regular grain offerings, you're to add oil and incense before bringing them. And in verse 15 of chapter 2, it says, the priest then burns the memorial portion as an offering made to Yahweh by fire. But again, it is not said to be an aroma pleasing to Yahweh. It's implied here, however, that the priest gets the rest of the sacrifice that wasn't the memorial portion, as with the other grain offerings that were not first fruit offerings. Okay, So we've made it through the burnt offering and the grain offerings, and that's chapters 1 and 2. Chapter 3 is the fellowship offering. So something about the fellowship offering. The fellowship offering is something that's also required for installing priests. We see that in chapter 9, later in Leviticus. It's the fellowship offering is also required during the Feast of Weeks. That's in chapter 23 of Leviticus. And it's also required to complete a Nazirite vow. And we see that in Numbers chapter 6. So let's dig in. In verses 1, 7, and 12, we see in verses 1 through 6 that the fellowship offering could be from the herd. It could be a cattle. And then from 7 through 11, there's a fellowship offering that you, if you don't have a cattle animal, it can be from the flocks, either the sheep or the goat, and there it can be either male or female. And then it goes on, and I'm getting ahead of myself here. Well, let me keep going in my notes. I'll bet they're less screwed up than my thinking at the moment. So, verses 1 and 6, if from the flocks, a sheep or a goat, it could be a male or a female. So verses 1 and 2, the person bringing the offering, not the priest, is to lay his hand on the head of the offering and slaughter it at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And so we see that same phrase in verses 6 through 8, which is an animal from the flock. He's supposed to do that again. And then verses 12 through 13, if his offering is a goat, he's to lay his hand on the head and slaughter in front of the tent of meeting. So again, that's the person himself, not the priest. But then in verses 2, 8, and 13, Aaron's sons, the priests, they're the ones that shall sprinkle the blood against the altar on all sides. Something also interesting from the offering, from this offering, the fellowship offering, what's really burned on the altar from the offering is only the fat, the kidneys, and the liver. They're to be offered to Yahweh by fire. And then the fat around all of those entrails. And then for sheep, it says that the tail fat, or the fat of the tail, is also to be offered by fire to Yahweh. So why is this? Why is it the kidneys and the liver are to be offered to Yahweh by fire? Well, possibly because the kidney and the liver and the fat around those things, these represented, in the old way of thinking way back then, the center of one's emotion. And so, you know, the King James speaks of the bowels of compassion, and, you know, NIV translate that for modern ears, you know, a heart of compassion. But, you know, these were seen as the seats of emotion of a person. And so maybe this represents an offering of one's deepest inner feelings. So that's one thought as to why those are being offered. Also, nearby pagan peoples at the time used the liver for divination. And here, the liver is burned in the fire immediately, just not giving any time or allowing for any such divination practices to be used in the fire. But in reality, the text doesn't give a reason for why it's the fat and the kidneys and the liver that are offered. Now, here there's no portion for the priests, unlike with the grain offering. And the rest of the offering is for the Israelite making the offering in his family. And that's unlike the burnt offering, which is wholly offered to Yah, or the grain offerings. So again, the grain offering is given both to Yahweh and the priests. The burnt offering is entirely for Yahweh. And here the fellowship is offering is given to Yahweh, but not entirely. Again, the remainder can be used by the offer to celebrate his peace, or communion, or fellowship with Yahweh. So, back to the text, verse 5. It says, for the cattle offered, the fat, the kidneys, and the liver are placed on top of the burnt offering. So, but wait, this is the fellowship offering. So apparently if there's a burnt offering already being burned on the altar of burnt offering, here the cattle being sacrificed for the fellowship offering, the fat, the kidneys, and the liver are to be placed on top of that. Verses 11 and 16, for the sheep and the goats, they are burned on the altar as food. This likely means that the sacrifices, yeah, so they're burned on the altar as food. Now, a lot of pagan deities around that time, and even in pagan places like India today, where they offer sacrifices to idols, they're very specific. They, you know, my wife and I were working among Indians for some time, and they say that they're feeding their gods, their idols. This is their food. Well, here it says that these things are to be burned on the altar as food. What are they talking about? Because really, the scripture doesn't talk about the sacrifices being offered to Yahweh so that Yahweh can eat them. It likely means that the sacrifices are to be prepared with care as if they were food, not because there's a concept of a need to feed Yahweh, because, again, that's not really there. Verses 5 and 16, you know, there's a repetition. The cattle and the goat offerings are an aroma pleasing to Yahweh. But verse 11, the sheep offering leaves out the phrase, an aroma pleasing to Yahweh. So, interestingly, you know, so we just finished the fellowship offering. So far, it's the burnt offering, the grain offering, and the fellowship offerings that we've looked at. The burnt and fellowship offerings are combined 47 times in the Bible, mentioned together. So these two offerings seem to go together. The burnt offering symbolized the giving of everything back to God who had given it in the first place, and the reconciliation between God and the sinner. The fellowship offering symbolized participation with God in the sacrifice as God returned part of the offering to the offerer. So, verse 17 of chapter 3, it says, this, the fellowship offering, is a lasting ordinance for generations to come, wherever you live. And so now here's the instruction. This is a lasting ordinance as well. You must not eat any fat or any blood. So it's been suggested that the prohibition against fat is because that is the best part, and therefore that part belongs to Yahweh. Another suggestion is that this only applies to sacrifices. And so the problem with that is this verse seems to suggest otherwise. So it's fat and blood. In Acts chapter 15, 29, chapter 15, verse 29, in the New Testament, when they're talking about, oh, can we let Gentiles into the covenant people of God, the decision came back, yes, we can, but they have to follow these certain things. And one of them was a prohibition against eating blood. And so that comes, I'm sure, from this verse right here in Leviticus 3:17. So here's an observation made by a commentator that while it's not obvious in most English translations, the Hebrew word for all or every, in Hebrew it's kol, is used in chapter 3 for the fellowship offering 7 times. And the word for fat is used in the chapter 12 times. So we've got the number 7 for every and all, and then number 12 used for fat. So some of us are into the numbers, and so this suggests perfection and completion. Okay, we're going to go into the sin offering. I want to mention here that, as I touched on earlier, I've given much detail for the first three offerings, and now we're going to get a little more skimpy for the offerings, because it can be a lot of detail for you to listen to, and it was a lot of detail for me to have the time to do the preparation. So that's a moment of honesty that maybe I shouldn't share with you. But so the next is the sin offering, and that goes from chapter 4, all of chapter 4 through 5:13. And so an outline of the chapter is, at verse 3, it's if the anointed priest sins. So 3 through 12 is what they're to do for the offering if the anointed priest sins. Okay, from verse 13 through 21 is what to do if, and you can see this in verse 13, if the whole Israelite community sins unintentionally. Okay, then verse 22 through 26 is when a leader sins unintentionally. And then verse 27 to the end of the chapter, or close to it, is if a member of the community sins unintentionally. So I see three things in this. One is that, so if the anointed priest sins, it doesn't say unintentionally. All the rest, the whole Israelite community, when a leader sins, if a member of the community sins, the others are all in unintentionally. But it says if the anointed priest sins. I'm thinking maybe that's because the idea would be that the anointed priest, he knows the law, and he's not going to be sinning without some knowledge of what's happening. For the rest of them, they slip, but they don't know the law quite as well, and their slips, their unintentionality is maybe assumed here. So that's one thing. Another thing that I shouldn't laugh at this, but so it says, if the anointed priest sins, if the whole Israelite community sins, when a leader sins, and if a member of the community sins. So everyone is if they sin, unless it's a political leader. I'm throwing in political because I live in the age that I do. And then it's not if he sins. Obviously, the political leader, again, I'm inserting the word political in today's context rather than that context. Obviously, a political leader will sin. So it's not if he sins, it's when he sins. Two comments about the unintentional sins. And again, with three of the groups, it says unintentional. First, and this is really contrary to what we see among many Christians today, is that unintentional disobedience is sin, and it makes us guilty. We see that plainly in this chapter. And, on the one hand, there's some reason to say the Lord knows what's in your heart, but I think way too often we lean on that to say, well, if I don't know about it, then my heart's not sinning, so therefore I'm not sinning. Well, that's not what the word says here at all. Unintentional disobedience is sin, and it makes one guilty. And we should be aware of that. I think that carries over into us as followers of Yeshua as well. Second, it's been said that there are not sacrifices for intentional sins. And, we don't see that among Christians, Christians that just focus on the New Testament. But among people in the Hebrew Roots movement, many will say that there are not sacrifices for intentional sins. And chapter 5, so we'll turn the page to chapter 5 here briefly, gives examples of these unintentional sins. We see in verse 1, if a person sins because he doesn't speak up when he hears a public charge to testify regarding something he's seen or learned about, he'll be held responsible. I would think someone's aware if they're not speaking up and they hear the call. Verse 2, if a person touches anything ceremonially unclean. So again, these are examples of the unintentional sins that were talked about in the previous chapter. Verse 3, if he touches human uncleanness, anything that would make him unclean, even though he's unaware of it, when he learns of it, he'll be guilty. Verse 4, if a person thoughtlessly takes an oath in any matter that one might carelessly swear about, even though he's unaware of it, in any case, when he learns of it, he'll be guilty. Okay, and then 5 kind of summarizes, when anyone is guilty in any of these ways, he must confess in what way he has sinned. And as a penalty for the sin he's committed, he must bring to Yahweh a female lamb or a goat as a sin offering, and the priest shall make atonement for him and his sin. Again, as I started to say before, it's been said that there are not sacrifices for intentional sins. But we see later in Leviticus in chapter 16, speaking of the Day of Atonement, we see there in those sacrifices, atonement is made for rebellion, whatever their sins may have been. That's chapter 16, verse 16. Again, the chapter is about the Day of Atonement and the sacrifices there. In verse 21, this is for wickedness and rebellion, all their sins. Verse 21, that the priest is making atonement for himself and for the people, verse 25, and that this is so that before Yahweh, this is verse 30, so that before Yahweh, the people of Israel will be clean from all their sins. So my point is, I've heard it said a lot in the Hebrew Roots movement that that in the Old Testament there was no sacrifice for intentional sin. And at least in the Day of Atonement, I see that there is. That's an annual thing, but that's what I'm seeing. So, the guilt offering. I told you we'd go more to the surface as we got further along. The guilt offering is chapter 5, verse 14, through chapter 6, verse 7. So, I had initially thought the Torah portion only went through 5:19, the end of chapter 5, but I'll touch on what's in chapter 6 as well. Again, 5:14 through 16, Yahweh says to Moses, when a person commits a violation and sins unintentionally in regard to any of Yahweh's holy things, he is to bring to Yahweh as a penalty. It is a guilt offering, and he will be forgiven. And so this first portion, the end of chapter 5, for the guilt offering, is when someone commits a sin against holy things. Verses 17 through 19, if a person sins and does what is forbidden in any of Yahweh's commands, even though he does not know it, he is guilty and will be held responsible. He is to bring to the priest as a guilt offering a ram. It goes on. In this way, the priest will make atonement for him. He will be forgiven of wrongdoing against Yahweh. So the guilt offering, the first part, which is from chapter 5, verse 14 through the end of the chapter, is when people sin against the holy things and when they do something against Yahweh's commands. Chapter 6 continues the guilt offering, but there it focuses on the offering for sinning against one's neighbor. And so that's the one sentence I can throw in about the first 7 verses of chapter 6 without having been prepared for going there. So in conclusion, Leviticus transitions from the glory cloud of Yahweh's dwelling among his people to how Yah's people are to really tend to Yah's presence among us and us dwelling in his presence. We do this today not by ignoring sacrifices or merely studying them in our Torah studies, but by living sacrificial lives unto him through Yeshua and offering ourselves, our treasure, and maybe one day soon our very lives to him, for him. Just kind of a personal story that, if nothing else, may be entertaining. Years ago, my wife Michelle and I belonged to a church and prayer ministry in Chicago called the Prayer Furnace. And a key verse for the ministry, and it was all about, it was a house of prayer, and the church was very focused on it too. A key verse for the ministry was taken from Leviticus chapter 6, just a little bit past our Torah portion today, where it's, again, talking of the burnt offering. So Leviticus 6:12 says, the fire on the altar, and this is the altar of burnt offering, this is the altar where the sacrifice is to be wholly offered unto Yahweh. So you connect this with Romans 12:1, present yourselves, present your bodies a living sacrifice unto the Lord. And so we look at this, at ourselves as the sacrifice of burnt offering in this prayer ministry's, values and vision. And so they look at 6:12, and this is the fire that's supposed to burn the burnt offering, which is our lives before the Lord. And it says in 6:12, the fire on the altar must be kept burning. It must never go out. This was the rallying cry of this ministry and church that Michelle and I were part of for, I'm going to say, 13, 14 years. And as I read this, as I talk about it, I can hear the pastor preaching, let the fire on the altar never go out. We need to be living sacrifices unto our Lord. He gave up his life for us. We are to live sacrificial lives unto him every day. So let the fire on the altar never go out. So obviously it was a pretty zealous group, and that's part of why we liked them. Well, Michelle and I felt the Lord calling us out of Chicago to move to the Middle East. And when we did this, we sold our house that we'd been in for many years. You know, our kids were grown and we had all the stuff, and we had to sacrifice lots of stuff, you know, and we moved to Jordan. And so we went from a 3-bedroom town home with, you know, 3 floors, including a finished basement, to more than a handful, but I think it was 10 suitcases, which is a lot for many people, but it was really paring down a lot for us. And so we had a free garage sale. That's a way to get rid of a lot of stuff. We sacrificed a lot of stuff to move to Jordan, but the commands of the Lord really are not grievous. When you sense he's calling you and you've got the zeal to follow the Lord in this way, it's exciting. Well, we were in Jordan for about a year and a half, and we moved from Amman up north to a place that nobody really moves from Amman to, this place up north. And we still don't know why today, but our house was raided and searched for an hour and a half by some government forces. I counted 17 people all dressed in black with guns drawn. And we never knew why they did that. Sometime later they called us up on the phone and said, you have to leave the country. You're no longer welcome here. I said, well, how long do we have, a month or two? And he said, a week or less. So we had finally gotten settled. We finally bought some stuff. We had furniture and over the previous year and a half, and we'd made a trip or two back to the U.S. We'd acquired little things and memories and knickknacks and stuff, but now we had this apartment that we had to get rid of, and we were leaving Jordan, and we ended up crossing over here into Israel. And as we were going through different things, because again, we had to pare down to a certain number of suitcases, and we had acquired a lot more stuff. And, having pared down considerably just a year and a half earlier, now we were, you know, the things we hung on to were things that we kind of treasured, even though we may have just acquired some of them in the previous year and a half. And I remember going through a drawer that was next to our bed and a little end table. We had a couple of them with Michelle because we had a lot of stuff. You know, you put them in drawers and stuff, and just going through together and saying, okay, we've got to be kind of brutal with ourselves and get rid of a lot of stuff. But there are things that, you know, we'll want to save it all, but we got to get rid of almost everything. So as we went through this drawer, I can still picture us. We're on our knees in the bedroom, pulled the drawer out of the little dresser. Drawer was on the floor, and we're going through things one by one. And you know, we'd look at something and Michelle would say, oh, Mark, but that's, you know, that's so precious. Someone gave this to us at this time. And I'd point to it and I'd say, fire of God! And we'd laugh and throw it in the garbage. And we'd go to the next thing and it would happen again. Fire of God! And we'd throw it in the garbage or, you know, the giveaway a pile or something like that. And so that was, for us, not quite a burnt offering. There are some things we kept and brought to Israel with us. But in a tangible way for us, you know, living in the time that we live, without a temple for giving sacrifices, we were offering our lives and things that were most precious to us up to Yah. And sorry for the emotion. I didn't think this would happen. But it was good. It's good. It's good to give up our lives to Yah because of his son and what he's done for us. He did shed his blood for us. He gave his all that we would be all his. And he calls us to be all his. I remember years ago when I met the Lord, the tail end of the Jesus movement, there'd be young guys, you know, just off drugs or maybe still on drugs a little bit saying, yeah, I'll give my life for the Lord. I'll give my life for Jesus. And we could see, well, maybe he was sincere in this zeal. But we had the counsel, you have to live for him first. You have to live for him and give up all the stuff that isn't what he wants in your life, in your mind, in your thinking, in your speaking, in your doing. And that's the living sacrifice that he calls us to. And so as we've gone through these offerings, these sacrifices today, let me just challenge us all and me and my wife yet again, because we need to be reminded of this all the time, to realize that the time of sacrifice, of offering of our lives and our possessions and our wealth isn't over. He calls us to it every day. If we want to hold on to our lives, we will lose them. But if we lose ourselves for Yeshua's sake and for the gospel of the kingdom, we will truly have life.